This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. When it comes to dating and relationships, there are so many new terms when referring to someone's insidious behavior. The latest is called gaslighting. Author and associate director of Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, Dr. Robin Stern, is going to break down what gaslighting is and how to protect yourself from it. Thanks for joining me, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the big chunk of it, could you explain to me what exactly is gaslighting?
So gaslighting is a form of manipulation that's intention is to sow seeds of doubt in the individual being targeted or in members of a group, hoping to make those people or that person question their own memory, their perception, and their sanity.
That sounds like some torture technique.
It is an aggressive, insidious, manipulative technique. It becomes torture when the person on the receiving end of the gaslighting begins to believe it and is then torturing themselves with second-guessing their own phone number, second-guessing their way of looking at the world, their reality. One of the things I talked a lot about in my book when it initially came out in 2007 was that gaslighting requires the participation of two people. The person who is working hard to sow those seeds of doubt in the individual and the individual who allows that to happen. I want to be careful that people who are listening to this don't hear that as that I'm blaming the person who is allowing it to happen to himself or herself, but rather empowering the person who is experiencing gaslighting to understand it and therefore stop it. Because if we were sitting around thinking, gee, am I going to let somebody manipulate my reality? Of course we wouldn't allow that to happen. But when somebody is doing it in a way that's under the radar, in a way that is using perhaps a vulnerability of yours and puts a mirror up to you and you have to say, oh, gee, maybe I am that sensitive. Maybe I do spend a lot of time thinking about that particular thing and I shouldn't. You end up second-guessing your own reality.
Now, is this something that you've just started noticing, or has this been going on for decades?
It's been going on for decades, and longer than that. Probably since people have learned through the way they were treated or through social learning how to gain control in a moment. What I have noticed is an increase in gaslighting and a popularity of the term over the last several years, especially since the circumstances pre-election, where people were talking about Donald Trump being a gaslighter, or even comedian John Oliver also talked about feeling that he himself was being gaslighted by Donald Trump, because in that, famous set of interviews that you may or may not have seen, he said, I never invited Mr. Trump to be on my show, but Mr. Trump kept insisting that I invited him, so much so that I went back with my producer to my producer and said, did we invite him to be on the show? And of course, they hadn't. But because, like many people who are using the technique of gaslighting, Mr. Trump and the people talking about his being invited on the show were so certain of their reality and so insistent over and over again on their reality that the person on the receiving end said, well, you know, they're insisting. Well, they're so certain. Maybe I should double check.
So gaslighting starts out as just second guessing yourself?
Gaslighting starts out as one person who is in a power role, in a dynamic, attempting to undermine the reality of the person they're trying to gaslight. And in that, what I call the gaslight tango, in that dance that the two people are doing, the person who is being gaslighted accepts that and begins to second guess themselves. So here's just an everyday example, which is pretty common, for example, in teenage life. You sit with your friends every day at school, and that's what you usually do for lunch. And in fact, as I'm bringing this example to mind, there was an episode in Odd Girl Out, the Lifetime TV movie about bullying, where this kind of scenario happened, and I may not be recounting it exactly. The person who is feeling vulnerable and left out confronts the clique leader, the leader of the clique, and says, hey, you know what? You haven't been inviting me to have lunch with you all week. Are you mad at me? And the person in power remember that the person who is being left out is now feeling vulnerable and less than. The person who is the leader of the clique is more empowered in that dynamic. And she says to the more vulnerable one, don't be silly. Whatever, you're so sensitive. And if, in fact, you are sensitive, if, in fact, that name suits you, fits you, matches who you think you are, you may walk away from that reaction, that interaction, saying to yourself, you know what, my God, she's right, I'm way too sensitive. But meanwhile, if you actually looked at the script of that conversation, the person who was the leader of the clique never responded to why she wasn't saving her friend a seat, never responded to whether or not she's mad at her friend. So instead of taking any responsibility or answering the question or the responding to the statement directly, she's basically putting it on the other person. And even if you're sensitive, it doesn't mean that she still didn't save you the seat.
It sounds more like a confidence issue than it is a manipulation tactic, or am I taking that wrong?
It's a confidence issue in that, on the receiving end, if you're not confident enough to hold on to your reality, then you allow your reality to be manipulated. So there are two different issues. I'm not so sure of myself. I don't feel really confident about my reality. So I'm maybe not going to make assertive statements. Maybe I'm not going to tell people the way the world works. I'm just not sure that I can see it that way, that clearly, that confidently. But to allow somebody else to tell you what it is takes advantage of the fact that you're not confident, takes advantage of the fact that you have a vulnerability about the way you hold your certainty. Because in what you're saying to me, what's the answer? Right? Just get more confidence?
I'll be honest. I want to say it's torture, because if there was an elephant in the room and you say to your partner, oh my God, there's an elephant in the room, and they stare you dead in the face and says, no, it isn't. It does make you question, like, maybe I am the one that's crazy. But if you're confident, can't you just say, like, well, hey, partner, there is an elephant. You're the one who's crazy. Come on, let me put your hand on it, you know?
Yes, exactly right. But when that happens every day or every other day or every time you're with that person over a period of time and you're saying, hey, you see that elephant? The person says, what are you talking about? There's no elephant here. Anybody else would know there's no elephant here. It's very hard to continue to hold on to that reality when the person giving you the information is very important to you and is powerful in your life. And so that's the key too, right? So it's not just that you say to me, Robin, you know what? There's six other people on the phone. Can't you hear them? And I say, there is nobody else on the phone. And you say, come on, can't you hear them? I'm going to think, okay, interesting radio show, but the host is a little bit out of reality and I don't think I'm continuing. But if my mother, or you're my best friend, or you're my lover, and I care about holding on to the relationship, and I care that you think that I know how to think clearly, and you're telling me what's happening, and I do have some difficulty holding on to my own reality, especially after you're telling me 12 times that there's something wrong with my reality, it's not going to be so easy for me to say, come on, you're crazy.
Now, the elephant in the room, obviously, that's a bit extreme, but are there different levels of gaslighting? Like, how does it start?
It starts with the kind of thing you were just talking about. The way I define them in the book is the first stage is called disbelief, the second stage is called defense, and the third stage is called depression. And they are not necessarily so linear, but it does start out in the way that you describe, where, let's say, your friend keeps you waiting every single time you make an appointment with them. So the first couple of times, you just dismiss it. You say, you know what, maybe something's going on. The third time, you say to your friend, you know what, like, I don't really like waiting for you on the movie line every single weekend where we have plans to go to the movies and you never show up on time. Your friend says, you really have a serious problem. Like, what's wrong with waiting? Who told you there's something wrong with waiting? Like, why are you so uptight? And you say to yourself, oh, God, you know what? She's absolutely wrong. Of course, being late is not cool. And then it keeps happening. And you keep saying to her, this is not okay. This is not okay. I don't feel respected. And she keeps saying back to you, you have a problem. You are so uptight. Why are you so rigid? Why do you have a fixed personality? And over time, you descend from the disbelief stage, which is the first, to defending yourself, saying, no, 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 I'm not that person. I don't have a fixed personality. I'm very open. It's just that, don't you see, it's really not cool to be late, to be keeping somebody waiting all the time. I know a lot of people who wouldn't like that. And so you begin to try to convince to defend yourself, and you begin to try to convince the other person that the way they're seeing the world is not right. And you have a big stake, and this is a really important part of stage two, which is defense. You have a big stake in making sure that they agree with you. And one of the ways that you know you're in stage two is you keep having the same argument. You keep defending yourself. And also you're ruminating about it in your mind. So you're thinking, well, you know, when she said that, I could have said this. And when she said that, maybe I didn't do a good job of defending myself. And that goes on for a period of time. And if it goes on for a period of time, you may end up in the third stage, which really is depression. And in that stage, often you're trying to prove the gaslighter is right so that you become your own gaslighter, in a sense. You say, you know what, like, there's something wrong with me. I am so uptight. I'm so rigid and fixed about these things. I can't even understand why somebody would want to be with me.
I'm trying to differentiate it, because when you brought up the movie thing and being late, I have a cousin, and he does this to me all the time. I mean, he is late for everything. And when I first started hanging out with him, it would be for the movies. I'd be like, okay, the movie's going to start at 4. We need to leave at 3:30 to get there on time. So I'll be at your house at 3. So I would go to his house. It's 3 o'clock. He's just getting out of the shower. He's, you know, everything is late. He's dragging his feet. Like, why are you making lunch right now? We should be leaving. And he would say, you know, you're just wound up. You need to relax a little bit. And for a long time, I thought, you know, hey, he's just being an ass. I never thought for a second like it was my problem that I was wanting to be on time.
But what if he were to say to you every time together, hey, you know what? You really have a problem. You really have a problem. Did you ever think that maybe it's just like some stupid American custom or some stupid custom in your family that people have to be on time? Like, why do I have to be on time? Who cares if we're late?
Well, that's the funny part. He would do that, because I would say, hey, I want to see the movie previews. That's for me. I'm paying for the previews, too, so I want to see it. And he's like, it's just the previews. It's not like, you know, we got a grace period of 15 minutes. You can live without it. My thing is that I would argue with him to the point where it's like, we're going to be on time, to heck with your lunch. And now he is on time with me. Everybody else, though, he's not on time, but I love that. And the thing is it's the approval. Is that the difference between someone who is being gaslighted? Is it the approval that you're looking for that suckers you into that depression stage?
It is. In the situation or in the example you're giving me, it would be important for you that your cousin sees it your way, that you're going to argue until he thinks well enough of you to think that the way you see it is really good, is the right way to see it. The fact that you argue with him is something that is a focus. If you're feeling gaslighted or you're being gaslighted, experiencing gaslighting in a relationship, one of the things that I think is important is to stop focusing on whether you're right or wrong and begin to focus on how you feel in the conversation. If you feel like you're being manipulated, or if you feel like there's something going on that's not cool, you're probably right. And it doesn't even matter who's right or wrong. What matters is that you're locked into this power struggle. So I might say, you know what, I'm not going to argue with you about this. I'm just going to step out of this power struggle. If you want to think it's cool not to be on time, that's fine. I don't agree. Because you're not being gaslighted. You're not buying it. You personally are not buying it. Yes? Am I right?
Right. Yeah, I wasn't buying it.
All right. So you're not buying it. And yet you're still in the argument, right? So why is it important for you to have that argument?
Oh, okay. So, and see, this is where I wanted to open it up. Gaslighting is such a specific term, and I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just plain manipulation. I mean, it is a manipulation, but it's something very specific, and it happens with power struggles. I get it now.
Yeah, it's happening in a power struggle, but the struggle is about the need to hold on to the relationship, the need to be right, the need to show that you are an okay partner, a good enough partner. There are so many instances where that were so extreme that I wanted to write about them in my book initially. People questioned me and said, nobody would even believe this. Here's an example. I was working with a young woman who took her boyfriend out to celebrate their anniversary. And over the dinner, she became tearful. And he told her that he loved how emotional she was being and how romantic it was, that she had tears glistening in her eyes because it was their anniversary. And she said, well, I am really moved, and I do love you. And I'm also tearful because, you know, I wish that our families were here celebrating with us. And that was a trigger for him. So at that moment, he basically threw his silverware on the table and said, you just ruined the dinner. And she said, what? What are you talking about? I just ruined the dinner. I'm just, you know, you made a comment about the fact that I have tears in my eyes, and I do, and I'm loving this moment with you, or some version of that, she said, and I'm also really missing our family. He couldn't take what he perceived to be the slight that she was thinking about anybody else at that moment but him, and by the end of the dinner, she was begging him to forgive her.
Wow.
Because if you think about that interaction, here's what he said to her. I didn't ruin the dinner. You ruined the dinner. If you didn't bring that up, I wouldn't have had to throw my silverware on the table. And is that technically true? Is it technically true that because she brought up a subject that was a trigger for him, he reacted? Yes, that is technically true. She brought it up. His reaction was throwing the silverware on the table. But nowhere in their conversation ever, and she left the relationship shortly thereafter, but nowhere in their conversation did he ever say, I'm sorry I threw the silverware. I didn't have to throw the silverware. I could have just said, you know what, I only want to hear about you and me tonight. You know what, I wish you weren't thinking about our families. Instead, he convinced her that she did a bad thing, that she ruined the evening. And when I saw her for the first time, that's what she came to therapy for, to find out if she had abused him.
That's a bit extreme. How did she take knowing that it was the other way around?
It took a while. It's a process of being able to tease apart that interaction, of her being able to see where the conversation veered off from a conversation to something else. When you're in that interaction, like what stopped her from just saying you're crazy?
Yeah, and that's where I get kind of confused at, because at what point do you just walk away? Because it just, if it quacks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it must be a duck. If he's acting crazy, then he must be crazy. You know, like this is inappropriate interaction here.
For example, if you grew up with a lot of ducks, that's you true. Might not think there's anything wrong with somebody acting like a duck, to use your metaphor.
If it's about relationships, you know, family, friends, you know, your personal life. What about professionally? Does this happen professionally?
Of course it does. It happens all the time. It happens in therapy. When I was doing research for my book, some of the interesting research that I found in English journals, British journals, as a matter of fact, were therapists gaslighting their patients. So it looks something like this. The patient says to the therapist, I'm feeling really great. I think it's time to stop therapy. And the therapist says something like, I'm really glad to hear that you're feeling great. I think that you always come up with a reason to leave therapy at a time where you're about to have a breakthrough. Or when you've just had a breakthrough. I don't think you're ready to leave. Oh, no, but I feel good. Things are happening. And then the therapist who is doing the gaslighting is then in a position to say, I see things that you don't see. I'm in a position of power here. I know what's going on and you don't. And in a treatment relationship, it can be very scary and very dangerous. Because there are certainly times where your patient would say something like that and you do feel like there's something else going on besides what the patient is telling you. But do we ever have the right to say to somebody, let me define your reality? I don't think so. We have the right to say, could there be another way to look at this and still leave it in the power of the patient or of the person? Could you imagine that there could be something else going on? Let's think about what happened last time. What were you feeling when you left last time? I've been to the grocery store so many times listening to parents and children who are in the playground in writing this book. So many small examples. The parents don't mean to be gaslighting their kids, but come on, you're not hungry. You're tired. Come on, I see you grabbing for that food, but you're not hungry. You just ate. Or one of the defining moments in my history that led me to write this book was watching a father tell his son that he was acting out, that he was bad, that he was clumsy, that he didn't know how to catch a ball. And you heard the child, if you were in the vicinity, you heard the child saying those very same things to themselves. I'm clumsy. I'm not good. I'm bad. So from a very early age, you rely on your parents to help you define yourself. You rely on your parents to validate your reality. And if your parents challenge your reality, oh, you don't hate your brother. No, he's a baby. Okay. Well, my mommy loves me more than anything. My daddy loves me more than anything. And why would they tell me something? That isn't true.
I'm glad you brought up parents, because when it comes to, you know, your boss or your partner or your friend, you can always cut off those ties if it becomes too much or I don't want to deal with it. They're not changing. But your parents, your family, how do you deal with gaslighting within your family?
With difficulty, the first answer. I think that it, again, it's a process. And I think if you think there's gaslighting going on, you do what you would do in any relationship, which would be to really sort out the truth from the distortion. So you would, I recommend to people all the time that they write down the conversation. Okay, I said, he said, I said, he said, and see when it becomes gaslighting rather than a responsive conversation. Decide whether the conversation is a power struggle, and if it is, opt out. You know what? I'm not going to engage in this. Let's come back together when we're not fighting about it. If you know that talking about having a holiday at your house is going to trigger your mother, then maybe you don't bring it up, or you don't bring it up in the way you've normally brought it up. Focus on your feelings rather than somebody's right or wrong. Hey, you know what? This conversation is not feeling right to me. I don't find that you think you're right. I think I'm right, too. We're going to have to agree to disagree. And importantly, you can't control anyone's opinion, even if you're right. So if you're in there, if you're in there with their cousin, or anyone is in there with their mom or their boyfriend or their best friend, trying to convince them that they should change their opinion, it's likely going to be unsuccessful. When walking away when somebody else thinks you're wrong, if you're really bought into that dynamic and you're really committed to having that person think well of you, it's very hard to do. When I was interviewing people who ran shelters for battered women and people who were working with women who had been physically abused, they across the board said to me that having somebody appropriate your reality and begin to tell you that you're crazy was far worse than getting black and blue mark. That would heal. It's maddening.
You've talked a lot about the gaslightees. Have you ever, during your practice, ever came across someone who was a gaslighter and they didn't realize it? Like, how did you help them?
Yes. A lot of it was helping them to understand that it was important, or why it was important for them to get control over the interaction. So people change when they're seriously uncomfortable, when there is the threat of losing someone, when they really have gotten to the point within their own integrity that they feel like they need to do something, or there's some other, what's the motivation, right? So when somebody's highly motivated to change, let's say, for example, it's your best friend or your partner or your husband or wife or your family members, and you are saying, I cannot continue this relationship if you continue to tell me what I'm thinking all the time. I can't take it anymore. I'm losing myself. I don't feel right. I'm not the same strong self that I was when I met you. My friends don't recognize me. I don't like the way I feel. Your partner may be motivated to say, okay, so I don't even get it. Like, what am I doing? Well, you know, every time you tell me what I'm feeling, you're doing it. So are you okay with my then saying to you, you're doing that thing again, or I need to walk away, or can you find another, can you find your feelings? Can you be an emotion scientist? I would ask the gaslighter, and really notice when you're triggered and when you're uncomfortable, and find a different way to manage your anxiety rather than to tell me that there's something wrong with me. So going back to the example of the teenager who says, hey, you didn't save me a seat at lunch, or I've been feeling excluded. In hearing that information, what did the leader of that clique feel? Did she feel uncomfortable and not know how to apologize? Did she feel guilty and not want to apologize? What could she have done rather than saying, whatever, you're so sensitive? Rather than trying to manipulate, to turn the table on the person who was bringing the issue up, could she have done something else with her own feelings?
Now, in your book, in the back, it's the appendix, it's Visualize Your Relationship. And it really acts like a pro and con list of your current relation, past and future portion of the relationship. And I wanted to talk about the future relationship part. Who's to say that you're not projecting? Like, oh, he's going to change, and, you know, my mother's going to love me from now on, you know, and they're going to be the best person ever. How do you know that when you're making this little list that you're doing it right?
A great question. There is no hard science answer. I think it's a question at that point when you're really unpacking, how am I typically in the world? How is this person typically in the world? And if you're going through the series of questions, can I act differently with this person? It's going to be hard, but I could imagine controlling myself. Is he capable of acting differently with me? So you are projecting into the future, and you don't really know the answer to that. But based on his motivation, based on whether you've ever seen him or her really manage his or her feelings in an effective way, whether they, the person in question is talking about wanting to be his or her best self. Am I willing to do the work it might take to change our dynamic? Well, maybe you're willing to do that work today, but tomorrow when you notice, or next week when you notice it, every single time you're having an interaction, you're having to say you're doing that thing again. You know, are you still going to be willing to do that work? It's hard. It's very hard. And if you give it your best effort, will you be happy with the relationship?
That's true. Well, Robin, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. For those listening, where can they find more information about you and your book?
So I am the Associate Director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. Our website is ei.yale.edu. You can find information about emotional intelligence and me on that website. You can find information about my book itself at robinstern.com or Google The Gaslight Effect.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's masonverapayne.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.